Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its implications for society. And today, we're going to devote the entire hour to outer space. That's right. We're entering perhaps the second golden era of space exploration, and we'll talk about some of the recent developments. Did you know, for example, that we almost had a near tragedy in outer space? The Soyuz space capsule, which was designed to send our astronauts from Kazakhstan into outer space to the International Space Station, had a misfire. Luckily, the astronauts there had an escape pod whereby they could parachute back down to the planet Earth. And the question is, well, why didn't we use that escape mechanism years ago when we lost 14 brave astronauts to accidents in space? So we'll talk about the risks of going into outer space. And also recently, NASA and the European Space Agency and the Japanese have sent probes to the Sun and to Mercury. And some people are saying, well, why? I mean, there's no life on the Sun. There's no life on Mercury. Mercury is a desolate planet. It's waterless. It's scorched by the solar flares from the Sun. So what do we have to gain by sending probes to the Sun and probes to Mercury when all the attention has been focused on planets like Mars and Saturn? And then let's say a few things about the Moon. Yes, we are going back to the Moon. Elon Musk, the billionaire, is sponsoring a new rocket, the BFR rocket, to take our astronauts not just to the Moon, but also to Mars. Now, he's a little bit coy about what the BFR stands for. We know that B stands for big, R stands for rocket, and F, well, that could pretty much stand for anything you want. And then let's say a few things about planet Mars. National Geographic is sponsoring several seasons worth of documentaries concerning Mars. It also uses actors and actresses to dramatize some of the hazards of going into outer space. In fact, I'm one of the talking heads in the program. And then lastly, we'll answer the question, well, why bother? I mean, outer space is so forbidding, it's so expensive. Why even bother to go into outer space when we have so many problems here on the planet Earth? Well, let's just jump right into our special program about outer space. As you mentioned, first of all, we had a near miss. That is, the Soyuz spacecraft, which sends our astronauts into outer space to the International Space Station, had a misfire just minutes after launch from the Kazakhstan spaceport. And you had to hold your fingers crossed because an escape capsule was ejected from the crippled spacecraft. And fortunately, the parachute unfolded and the astronauts safely landed back on the planet Earth. And then you may ask yourself another question. Well, we dodged the bullet this time, but why in the past didn't we have a similar escape mechanism for our astronauts? I mean, NASA lost 14 astronauts because of two accidents with regards to the space shuttle. I mean, why? Why didn't we have that escape capsule back then? Well, first of all, we've been sort of brainwashed by the media into thinking that space travel is a Sunday picnic. Well, it's not. The misfire rate for a booster rocket going into outer space is about 1%. 1% of the time, you enter that space capsule and you never come back. That's right. We're, 60 years into the space age, and still we cannot get that number much less than about 1%. And if you think about it, the space shuttle had two accidents, and how many missions were there? Roughly 200 missions. And so we have the situation where the space shuttle, with two explosions of the module, actually happened more or less on schedule. 1% of the time, you never come back. And the question is, what's some of the reasons why? Well, of course, rockets have lots of moving parts, and you're sitting on millions of gallons worth of rocket fuel. And so its conditions are ripe for an accident. But there's also another reason why we have accidents with regards to our rockets, which was revealed by Nobel laureate Richard Feynman. Richard Feynman investigated the shuttle accident, and he met with the senior engineers for NASA, and he gave them each a sheet of paper. And he asked them to write on that sheet of paper what they thought the estimates were for a catastrophic accident in space. Well, these were engineers, seasoned engineers, and they all wrote down something like 1%. Something like 1% of the time, yes, our rockets are going to blow up. However, one person refused to turn in that sheet of paper. Finally, when he was asked to write down the probability of another accident, he wrote down the word never. Now, that violates common sense. That violates the laws of statistics and probably the laws of physics. He wrote down never. And then Feynman figured it out. That man who wrote down never was just like all the other engineers in that room, except for one thing. And that was, he was an engineer who got promoted into the ranks of management. And in management, your priorities are different. If you're that engineer on the ground, you want to A, make sure that rocket goes up, and B, you want to make sure that that rocket doesn't explode. But you see, once you become a senior bureaucrat, once you're in charge of budgets and all these other considerations, many of them political, then all of a sudden your priorities slowly begin to change. And wishful thinking begins to set in because you have budgets to meet, you have deadlines to meet, and that's why he wrote down the word never. Well, get used to it. We're going to have other accidents with regards to our astronauts, and hopefully they will have an escape mechanism each time. Now, why didn't we have an escape mechanism for the space shuttle? The answer is cost. We could have done it, but it costs too much money. And as a consequence, 14 of our brave astronauts perished in the process. However, the people who actually engineer these rockets, make these rockets, they know that, yes, many times these rockets misfire. For example, when you look at the planet Mars, there's the Mars Jinx. The Mars Jinx is the fact that only about one-third of the space probes that we send to Mars actually make it. Two-thirds of them never make the red planet. In fact, Elon Musk, who is fielding his own moon/Mars rocket, the BFR, was asked whether he would want to go into his own capsule and go to Mars. Well, he said yes. He'd be delighted to go to Mars, except not on impact. In other words, if it means dying on Mars, he would prefer not to go into outer space, even on one of his own rockets. And speaking about rockets, the Sun, Mercury have been in the news. NASA is sending space probes to other areas of the universe, along with the Japanese and the European Space Agency. First, the Sun. Well, that got a certain amount of criticism because people said, well, there's no life on the sun. It's hot. We know it's hot. So why bother to send a probe to the sun? It's expensive. The instruments will be fried if they don't go on the right trajectory. What do we have to learn? Well, the answer is quite a bit. It turns out that much of the weather on the planet Earth is directly or indirectly controlled by the sun. And we know actually very little about the sun. We have the equations for thermodynamics, the equations for fusion. That gives us the gross properties of the sun, the rate at which it burns hydrogen, and the rate at which it emits energy. But what about fluctuations? For example, during the Middle Ages, we had the Little Ice Age. That's right. If you take a look at paintings done during a certain era of the Middle Ages, it turns out that these paintings show that many of the famous rivers and lakes of Europe, which are ice-free, were frozen solid during wintertime, ice skating in lakes that today have no ice at all. And so we know that things were colder. Things were a lot colder during the Middle Ages, and that's called the Mini Ice Age. And the question is, why? Well, we don't really know. One theory is that perhaps the sun's energy fluctuates, but that's just a theory. We want to test some of these theories, and that's one reason for launching the probe to the sun. Another reason for sending a probe to the sun is because once in a while, the sun has a temper tantrum, blows its top, and sends a huge amount of radiation into outer space in the form of a solar flare or a coronal mass discharge. The last big one was in 1859 called the Carrington Event. Google it, Carrington Event. It was an event that we hope will never be repeated again because back then, in the 1800s, it not only caused a show of northern lights because of all that radiation coming from the sun, it turns out that the northern lights went as south as Cuba. That's right, people in Cuba could read the newspaper by the light of the northern lights, and telegraph wires went berserk. All of a sudden, the air was electrified, meaning that telegraph wires would spontaneously start up and cause sparks and fires. Now, we physicists today can take these two facts, the fact that the northern lights went all the way down to Cuba and the fact that telegraph wires were set afire, and then calculate the electric field density that caused these things. And the numbers we find are incredible, absolutely staggering. It turns out that physicists estimate that if it were to happen today, not in 1859, but today, property damage would be on the order of $2 trillion. That's trillion with a T, not a B. And that means that not only would our satellites be knocked out because of a solar flare, it also means that power stations on the Earth, all over the Earth, could get knocked out, meaning that all of a sudden you have a blackout, but the rescue crews are not going to come because they too have been afflicted by the gigantic solar flare. In other words, your food is going to rot. In just a few days, we may have food riots. Commerce will come to a halt. I mean, simple things like credit card transactions will be knocked out. Recently, we had a blackout that hit Times Square. And sure enough, all the tourists in Times Square could not check into their hotel room, and they had to sleep in the lobby as a consequence in Times Square. This means that power plants will be knocked out, satellites will be knocked out, astronauts in outer space will have to be extremely careful. We're going to be thrown back maybe 100, 200 years into the past. And that's with a solar flare. The big question is, can it happen again? And the answer is yes. In fact, it almost happened. We now know that sunspots are like cannons. Sunspots hurl enormous amounts of plasma in a solar flare into outer space, sort of like shooting bullets out of a gun. Fortunately, there's a lot of real estate out there, so even though a solar flare is shot out of the sun from its sunspots, usually they miss the Earth. However, we now track these things. We didn't before, but now we're very interested in this, and we dodged the bullet. Yes, just a few years ago, we had another potential Carrington event, but it missed the planet Earth. If it had hit, we would still be in the phases of recovering from that horrible coronal mass ejection, which could wipe out telecommunications on the Earth, because we are so dependent. We're so dependent on electricity for the internet, for communications, for daily transactions, for industry. Like I said, we'd be thrown back 100, 200 years back into the past. Now, what is the frequency overall of these coronal mass discharges? We don't know. Going to the poles, we can get ice cores and analyze ice and snow that fell thousands of years ago. And when we do that and calculate the time at which the snow fell, we realize that, yes, there was another Carrington event a few hundred years ago. And so it means that, A, these coronal mass discharges happen almost all the time, but fortunately, we dodged the bullet. But B, sometimes we get a direct hit. And when that happens, watch out. So far, the only knowledge that we have is that they take place on a matter of centuries, but who knows for sure? Also, speaking about outer space, the moon is back in the news. Given the fact that we had the first great era of moon exploration in the 1960s, then it collapsed. Now it's coming back. We're entering now the second golden era of lunar exploration. But why? Well, you have to realize that back in 1966, the Apollo space program consumed 5% of the entire federal budget. Now, let me repeat that again. In 1966, the Apollo space program soaked up 5% of every tax dollar that you send to the federal government. That is unsustainable. You can't maintain that forever. And sure enough, just a few years later, the United States lost interest in going back to the moon. We beat the Russians. We realized how expensive it was, and it was simply knocked out of the federal budget. And we have not been to the moon in 50 years as a consequence. Now things are changing. Costs are dropping. You know the movie The Martian, starring Matt Damon? That movie cost $100 million to make. $100 million. But the Indian government sent a probe past Mars for $70 million. This means that a Hollywood movie about going to Mars actually costs more than actually going to Mars. That's how cheap space travel has become, so that even the Indian government can field successful space launches and take gorgeous photographs of the planet Mars. Now, this also means that reusable rockets are going to lower the cost of space travel even more. Elon Musk and also Jeff Bezos, these are two billionaires heavily investing in rockets. In fact, we may not have one moon rocket. We may have three moon rockets capable of reaching the moon. One of them is the SLS. That is the booster rocket of NASA, paid for by you and me. Our tax dollars pay for the SLS rocket. It's scheduled to orbit around the moon in late 2019. Next year, we're going back to the moon. Now, Elon Musk, not to be outdone, has the Falcon Heavy. The Falcon Heavy rocket has a capsule, the Dragon module, fully capable of reaching the moon. So we have two moon rockets ready to go. They've been fired up and tested. So we have two moon rockets, one moon rocket paid for by taxpayers, the other by a private billionaire. And Jeff Bezos, richest man on Earth, not to be outdone, he's also invested in a spaceport in Texas, where he hopes to shoot the new Armstrong rocket to the moon. Now, it hasn't been tested yet, and is still in the drawing phases, but think about that. Not one, not two, but three moon rockets capable of sending astronauts to the moon. And Elon Musk, ever the showman, not to be outdone, also announced that a Japanese billionaire has bought out all the seats on his moon rocket, meaning that, yes, passengers are already signing up to go back to the moon. This means, of course, a whole new renaissance in space exploration. Some people are saying that with the falling cost of space travel, mom and dad may be able to go into outer space. Our kids may be able to fulfill some of their fantasies about becoming an astronaut. And our grandkids may even honeymoon on the moon. That's right. It only takes 3 days, a hop, skip, and a jump to reach the moon. You could go to the moon and come back on the weekend. So some people think that space tourism could be the way to go. And then the next question is, why? I mean, why are we doing this anyway? I mean, after all, it is expensive, even with the falling price of rocketry. And it is dangerous. 1% of the time, as I mentioned, rockets tend to blow up. Well, I once interviewed Carl Sagan for this radio program, and I asked him that question. I said, look, we have so many problems on the Earth, global warming, nuclear proliferation, germs. Why go to the stars? And he gave me an answer that sort of caught me off guard. He said, quote, "We have to become a two-planet species. Why? Because we live in the middle of a cosmic shooting gallery. So many asteroids, so many comets and meteors whizzing by, we are blissfully unaware of the fact that they are near misses all the time. Now, of course, these things don't happen often, thank goodness, or else we wouldn't be here right now to talk about it. But it does mean," he said, "that at some point, we have to leave the Earth. At some point, it's simply going to be too dangerous to put humans on the planet Earth. On a scale of, for example, hundreds of years, we have the threat of a supervolcano like the one in Yellowstone National Park. On a scale of thousands of years, we have to worry about another ice age. That's right, in about 10,000 years or so, where I'm sitting right now in Manhattan, we'll be under perhaps a half a mile of ice, like it was 10,000 years ago. And then on a scale of tens of millions of years, we have the possibility of another killer asteroid, just like the one that knocked out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. You know, the dinosaurs did not have a space program, and that's why they're not here today. We do have a space program, and so we can also choose our fate. And then, let's do an experiment. Dig right underneath your feet right now. That's right. Dig right through all the concrete and wood and rock right underneath your feet. What are you going to find? Fossils. Lots of fossils. But these fossils are of life forms that are extinct. In fact, 99% of all life forms eventually go extinct. Extinction is the norm for Mother Nature. Let me repeat that again. Many people have this feeling that Mother Nature is warm and cuddly. However, extinction is the norm. Of all the life forms that have been on the planet Earth, only the tiniest fraction of them are still on the planet Earth. So we have to buck the odds. The odds are 99.9% that we too will also go extinct for any number of the reasons that I mentioned. And that's why Carl Sagan said, look, as an insurance policy, as plan B, as a backup plan, why not have a settlement on Mars? Now, he wasn't advocating evacuating the Earth. No, that'd be impossible. It would cost too much. And why bother? No, we're talking about a settlement that is self-sufficient. In other words, they're on their own. Once they get there, they're going to have to biologically engineer crops to grow on the surface of Mars. They're going to have to mine the ice to extract drinking water and hydrogen and oxygen for rocket fuel and for breathing. They're going to have to get sunlight from the sun in order to energize their machines. They have to become self-sufficient. And that's one of the reasons why, cost-wise, only the first settlement will be expensive. And after that, the colony will be self-sufficient. So in other words, according to Carl Sagan, we have no choice. We have to leave the Earth. Now, on a scale of billions of years, we will face the death of the sun. Now, the poets like to say everything will end in fire or ice. Well, I'm a physicist. We can now answer these questions. How will the Earth die? The Earth will die in fire because the sun will expand into a red giant star. One day we will have the last nice day. The sun will expand from one point of the horizon to the next. It means the oceans will boil, the mountains will melt, and from dust to dust, ashes to ashes, physicists say, from stardust we came, and stardust we will turn. Now, how will the sun die? The sun will die in ice. It'll burn out as nuclear fuel and eventually become a dead black dwarf. And how will the Milky Way galaxy die? We see the galaxy every night lighting up the night sky. The galaxy will end in fire because it will collide with Andromeda, a nearby galaxy. And since Andromeda is bigger than the Milky Way galaxy, it will gobble up, eat up the Milky Way galaxy. And how will the universe die? Well, we're not sure, but the latest evidence seems to indicate that the universe will die in ice. It'll expand forever. One day we will look up at the skies and see nothing. All the stars will have moved away so fast, light cannot even reach us. And at that point, temperatures will plunge to near absolute zero, and all life will cease to exist. Sorry about that. Well, there is one loophole. One loophole in all this is to exploit Einstein's equations, which allow for wormholes. Maybe one day we'll have enough energy, trillions of years from now, to build a lifeboat, an interdimensional lifeboat, whereby we can leave our dying universe and enter another young universe, and then perhaps even mess up that universe as well. Now, this is not pure science fiction. It turns out one of the solutions of Einstein's equations give you wormholes. In fact, the late Stephen Hawking posthumously has published a book where he says, yes, wormholes, even time travel, they are solutions of Einstein's equations, and who knows, they may in fact be possible. Now, this, of course, is not for us. It's for technology millennia, millions of years, maybe even billions of years more advanced than us. But at that point, billions of years from now, civilization may be able to harness enough power to create a hole in space, stabilize that hole, and use it for the ultimate gateway to another universe. So when the universe dies, we do not necessarily have to die with the universe. Now, all this may sound like science fiction, and much of it is. However, it's based on Einstein's theory of general relativity and the quantum theory. It turns out that, yes, Einstein's equations do allow for the possibility of tearing the fabric of space-time. The quantum theory opens the possibility of stabilizing that tear in the fabric of space and time. And perhaps in the future, one day we may be able to escape the death of the universe itself. So human ingenuity has always been with us. It's the reason why the dinosaurs are not here today, but we are. We are here today, and we're here to contemplate even the most horrific consequences that could befell our universe. So it means that human ingenuity may once again prevail. So when people ask me the question, of what use is physics and string theory and the unified field theory, I tell them that, well, maybe one day it'll save us from the death of the Earth, the death of the Sun, the death of the galaxy, and the death, maybe, of the universe itself. Perhaps it may be the saving grace for all intelligent life in our universe. Not bad for a theory. Well, that concludes the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku of the City University of New York. And in the second part of Exploration, we're going to continue our discussion of space travel by bringing on an astronaut. Astronaut Tom Jones of NASA. He's been in outer space. He's been to the space station. And he'll talk about, well, what does it take to become an astronaut? Are we entering the second golden era of space exploration? NASA is no longer the agency to nowhere. Now we're going some places. And what are the dangers? What are the promises and perils of what happens when we go back to the moon? Stay tuned. Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we talked about a potential second golden era of space travel. The cost of space travel is dropping. dropping to the point where people are envisioning space tourism. Billionaires from Silicon Valley are fielding their own rockets. Not one, not two, but three potential moon rockets to go back to the moon. The first is the SLS booster rocket with the Orion module, paid for by you and me, by NASA and taxpayers' money. And then Elon Musk, not to be outdone, has already tested the Falcon Heavy, fully capable of sending the Dragon capsule around the moon. But wait, he wants to go to Mars. And so he's already talking about firing up the BFR rocket, even bigger than the Falcon Heavy. And then the founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, richest man on earth, not to be outdone. He is fielding the new Armstrong rocket and building a spaceport, not at Cape Canaveral, but in Texas. So with all this activity, the question is, well, how safe is it? What does it mean for the astronauts? So with us today is an astronaut, Tom Jones. And Tom Jones will talk to us about how to become an astronaut, what to experience, and what might a trip one day to the far reaches of outer space may look like. So once again, our special guest today is NASA astronaut Tom Jones. The first question for you, Dr. Jones, is, as a youth, how did you first get interested in exploration and the space program?
It's easy to remember for me. My grandmother was a big reader, and so she went down to the five and dime store and bought on the remnant table a book called Spaceflight, The Coming Exploration of the Universe. It was one of these little golden books of knowledge that you could get back in the 1960s. And so I was five, and she gave me this book, and it was filled with wonderful illustrations, paintings of what spaceflight might be like. There were no photos because no one had gone into space yet. But that really captured my imagination. These astronauts and spaceships were fascinating subjects to me. So I began to read more about those on trips to the library and very quickly got fascinated with the subject of space science and astronomy. When I was 12, my parents got our family our first telescope, and I became the sole operator of it.
it was tough to get other people to let
other people use it, but I had it out a lot in suburban Baltimore. And along with the fact that they were building rockets in my hometown as part of the Gemini program in the middle 60s, I think all of these things combined to make astronautics and astronomy a very favorite subject of mine, which I just devoured in school and at the library.
And you went to the United States Air Force Academy. Why'd you go there, and did you have in the back of your mind this career path that would take you into outer space?
Well, certainly by the age of 10, I was aware of the job of astronaut and the fact that it was a reality and that they were building rockets in my hometown. And I said, well, I'd like to ride a machine like that someday. And during the Apollo program, as we watched the first run-ups to the moon landings, I was aware that test pilots were the ones who were selected to be astronauts. So if I wanted to do the job, I certainly had to become a test pilot. And you've got to go through a military flight training program. And I chose the Air Force. So the Air Force Academy seemed to me the best place that was focused on flying in the country. And that's why I tried to enroll there. By the time I was in college, the moon landings were just finishing. And so it was very clear that I still wanted to do this, and I thought that was a great jump on the program, getting into flight school, becoming an Air Force pilot, and then becoming a test pilot.
And I understand that you flew missions on B-52 bombers for the Strategic Air Command. Could you elaborate?
Well, after a year of pilot training after graduation, I got a basic science degree at the Air Force Academy. I knew I was going to be flying for a while and then try to get into test pilot school. So my first assignment after pilot training was to go to Strategic Air Command, which was an outfit that was involved in nuclear deterrence. And my mission as a B-52 crew member, a co-pilot, and then an aircraft commander, was to sit alert duty out at the base about once every 3 weeks. I would live for an entire week out at the base trying to make sure that the Russians would always fear a counterattack if they tried to do a surprise attack on the U.S. So we trained for the nuclear delivery mission, a doomsday mission. And it was quite a strange existence. Every third week, you'd be waiting for the horn to blow, signaling a Russian attack, and then you'd jump into your planes and taxi out as fast as you could and take off. That's what we trained for. And fortunately, nobody ever shot at me, and the Cold War wound down to its eventual conclusion. While I was doing that, though, NASA brought along the space shuttle and changed the rules on how you could become an astronaut.
Now, many people who watched the movie, Top Gun with Tom Cruise, have dreamed about dogfights up there in the wild blue yonder. However, you went for a PhD in planetary sciences. So how did that come about?
Well, to tell you the truth, I was in the Air Force and sitting alert duty, and I remember clearly being out there on the base during one of those weeks of duty and watching the miniseries Cosmos by Carl Sagan. And this was a man in a television production that really captured my imagination. And I said, here's a guy who's doing this for a career, the thing that I've loved to study and read about all these years. And now that NASA is looking for scientists and engineers, maybe I can become a space scientist, and maybe that would be an alternate path. I knew that test piloting would be a tough assignment to get. It was very competitive in the Air Force, and especially for bomber pilots who weren't widely needed at that time. So after watching Cosmos and reading some more books about that particular profession, I decided I'd go back to graduate school and see if I could become a practicing research scientist.
Now, a lot of people ask the question, if I want to become an astronaut, what do I do? Do I send a postcard to NASA saying, sign me up? What is the career path? What is the process by which somebody out there can realize a dream of going into outer space?
Well, it's easier today with the Internet. You can get on the Internet and read all about astronaut selection at NASA.gov, NASA.gov, their website, and search for astronaut selection. But back then, you just wrote a letter to the Johnson Space Center in Houston where the astronauts train, and I got a reply back from the selection office, and they informed me about the basic qualifications. You have to send in an application, which includes a big civil service exam and a lot of paperwork to fill out, as well as a medical exam. And you just send in that application. They keep it on file, and then every time that they select a new group of astronauts, they'll notify you to see whether you're still interested in applying. And so I started that process in 1986.
Now, 1986 was also a watershed year because that's when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up on international television, a very sobering event. Seven astronauts tragically lost their lives in that accident. And we sometimes forget that going into outer space is not a Sunday picnic, that about 1% of the time there is booster rocket failure and major malfunction of rockets. So was that sobering? How did that impact on you?
Oh, it was terrible. I was watching that accident. I was watching with the launch of that mission with Krista McAuliffe, the first school teacher to go into space, with a bunch of school students, elementary school students at the University of Arizona, where I was a graduate student. And the catastrophe unfolded before us on this big screen TV. And, you know, you had to try to make some sense of it for the kids and tell the kids that there was no hope that they had gotten out. And it was a terrible emotional blow. Next door at the Lunar and Planetary Lab where I was studying, everyone was completely floored, devastated by this emotionally, even though most of the people were involved in planetary science and astronomy and robotic missions. They knew how serious this was for the future of space travel and exploration in general, so it was a real body blow. I had met the commander of that mission about a year before, and he'd encouraged me to apply to become an astronaut. He was a very motivated guy who was clear about his mission. And it was infectious. It motivated me to follow in his footsteps. And after his death, Dick Scobee, I decided that, well, he must have really believed in this to risk his life in such a way. And I knew that my desire to do it was very strong. And I thought if people like that I look up to are willing to risk their lives, then I still think I could find the courage to do the same thing. And I talked it over with my wife before I began applying.
Now, you're a former test pilot, and you know when you go into that cockpit that you're putting your life on the line. You know that unlike a civilian, which wants lots of life insurance and assurances, there's no problem. You know you're putting your life on the line when you go into a jet airplane. Now, when you become an astronaut, are the astronauts also told the same thing? We have civilians going into outer space. We have politicians and multimillionaires now going into outer space. Are they really mentally prepared for the fact that, well, like I mentioned, roughly 1% of the time there is catastrophic failure?
Well, we're certainly aware of the risks. As a pilot, I didn't become a test pilot. I actually left the Air Force after just flying bombers because I wanted to pursue the science path. But I knew that the professionals involved in flying the shuttle were aware of the risks. Of course, Scobee certainly was. And I decided that there must be a recognition among all the crew members that what they're doing must register on them as being so worthwhile that they're willing to risk their physical safety, even their lives, to accomplish these missions. And when I got into the Astronaut Corps in 1990, I found that to be true, that people were thinking of this as a long-term program of exploration. They figured that the benefits they'd bring back from each mission would be building blocks that future explorers would use to return to the moon, get to the asteroids and Mars. So we all view this as a continuum, and each little contribution that we made was worth the risk of our lives. Now, the shuttle's a pretty safe machine, even though it's had two terrible accidents. It's one of the most reliable rockets that's out there. So you can always tell yourself that it's not going to happen to you, but you must recognize that it's a finite possibility that each mission's got, you know, one in a couple of hundred chances of leading to a catastrophe.
Okay, now let's get into the guts of your book. That is the training of an astronaut and what it's like there to orbit the Earth and look down from outer space. First of all, the training. Let's talk about going into swimming pools, going into 1,000 horsepower centrifuges, going into the Vomit Comet. What is the grueling regimen that astronaut training entails?
Well, to begin with, it's much like a college curriculum of investigating the basics of spaceflight. So you bring in all these people who are test pilots and scientists and engineers, and they have varied backgrounds, but everyone's capable of learning. And so essentially it's a graduate course in spaceflight and its fundamentals and the systems that allow us to survive and work up there, the space shuttle in this case. So it's a year of astronaut basic training. And you start in a classroom, read a lot of books, get a lot of lectures. So that's very familiar to most of us. And yet it moves very quickly into simulator training, where you're actually flipping switches, reading checklists, working as a team to put into practice what you've learned in the classroom. And there are also a lot of ancillary training experiences that are quite fun, even though they're very serious in mind, like survival training. What do you do if you bail out of a jet or out of the shuttle and you come down in some distant location where you've got to await rescue? So we had water and land survival training. We also, as you say, rode the centrifuge to prepare us for the accelerations of launch, scuba training to prepare us for underwater training in a spacesuit to simulate free fall, and finally that ride on the Vomit Comet that everybody looks forward to, where you get 20-second doses of free fall as the airplane rides this roller coaster path through the sky. And that's both exuberant and exhilarating, and then finally in the end it's an endurance contest to see if you can keep your stomach and your mind together while this airplane does these gyrations. But it's great to experience free fall.
Now, people who saw the movie Apollo 13 saw Tom Hanks floating for what seemed like forever. And people said, well, how'd they do that? There's no room for wires in that tiny little capsule. How'd they get Tom Hanks to float like that? And as you mentioned, it was this airplane called the Vomit Comet. And there's a reason for that. People throw up. Is that right?
Well, some do. Most people get a little queasy after the end of an hour and a half on that plane, where you do 40 up and down roller coaster cycles to give you those cycles of weightlessness that last 20 or 25 seconds. It's very aggravating to be in free fall for 25 seconds and then be slammed to the floor with two times the force of gravity as you pull out. And when you do that over and over, it tends to tumble your gyros and lead to nausea. I found that I never really got aggressively sick up there, but I certainly felt after the end of those 40 parabolas that I was ready to walk wobbly off the airplane and go sit down quietly for a while.
And let's talk about weightlessness. Weightlessness is the state of free fall. That is, if you're in an elevator and someone cuts the wire of the elevator, God forbid, you are in free fall and you are weightless because the floor of the elevator falls at the same rate that you do, giving you the illusion that there's no gravity. Of course, there's gravity. It's pulling you to the floor, but the floor is falling at the same rate as you. Same thing with the Vomit Comet. You're essentially being hurled like a rock into the atmosphere, and you are in free fall. So the question is, if you're in free fall, that sensation is a sensation of dying. That is, you're falling off a skyscraper. So is that the sensation that you have, that you're thrown like a rock into the atmosphere in the Vomit Comet? Is a sensation like the sensation that you're dying?
Well, fortunately, your body is pretty easily fooled. Your mind is fooled because you're in a cabin of an aircraft or you're in the cabin of a space shuttle, and you can't tell that you're being hurtled through the atmosphere or around the planet at hundreds or thousands of miles per hour as you fall, either on this roller coaster parabola or, you know, in an orbit around the Earth. So to you, your surroundings are falling with you. They all appear motionless. That's your frame of reference. And so you just appear to be floating. And so it's rather a gentle feeling. You don't feel any motion of high speed or even standing on the edge of a precipice and leaping off. So it's pretty easy to get used to. It's just a gentle lifting or a floating feeling. And it's nice to be able to move with just a fingertip push against the walls. And I find it's something that you actually forget about after a couple of days.
Now, you spent 52 days in Earth orbit during the 11 years you were in the astronaut program. So everyone wants to know, if you're up there for not just 20 seconds, but for days on end, how do you do very simple bodily functions? Like, for example, eating. How do you eat when your food floats in front of you? How do you drink if water will simply float to the ceiling? And what the question everyone wants to know is, how do you go to the bathroom?
Well, all of those subjects I try to explore in skywalking to give you that personal experience of being in there. Eating, fortunately, is almost a non-issue. All of your swallowing and digestive functions seem to work just fine with the peristalsis that moves things through your digestive tract at work. Doesn't need gravity to function. You do have to eat these foods out of a pouch and drink liquids from a pouch with a straw inserted so that food and debris and globules of liquid don't float around the cabin and mess up the systems up there. So it's rather tedious after a while that you have to eat one package at a time. You don't get to sample three or four dishes at once. You've got to eat in a serial fashion, and it almost becomes perfunctory after a week of the novelty wearing off. So, but it's aside from a little bit of extra time and care required, it's actually quite easy to eat and drink. And I still enjoy the varied menu that we had available to us, even though the foods aren't fresh. They're at least freeze-dried or irradiated or thermostabilized, so they retain some good flavors. Now, the bathroom question, down here on the ground, gravity makes everything go where it's supposed to. And as I write in the pages of Skywalking up there, you've got some special training to use because we use air instead of gravity to make things go where they're supposed to. Liquid down a suction hose where each crew member uses a personal funnel to guide the liquid into the tube. And for solid waste, it's blown into a storage tank underneath the commode seat. And then the clever thing about it is that the solid waste tank, while it's not in use, is exposed to a vacuum. So the solid waste is sterilized and dehydrated, so the next time it's used, there's no odor or chance of a pathogen getting back into the cabin. It's quite clever. And while it takes longer to use the system than on Earth, it actually functions quite well.
Well, according to the book, The Right Stuff, by Tom Wolfe, when our first astronaut, Alan Shepard, was sent into a suborbital trajectory, he had to go to the bathroom. He told Mission Control he had to go to the bathroom, and Mission Control vetoed it. And so they sent him into outer space, where he essentially urinated in outer space. Now, that is not a good thing to do, right? Because if you have liquid inside your spacesuit and you are weightless, it could be a mess, right?
Well, it certainly was a mess, and I'm sure he was quite a smelly guy when he came back and got out of the suit. But he survived just fine, and that's because of spacesuit design. They don't put any electronics generally inside an oxygen-filled suit unless there be an ignition source that could lead to a fire. So the inside of a spacesuit tends to be a quite benign place, and the liquid was just a little bit of mess. Fortunately, on the space shuttle, we deal with free fall inside a spacesuit by using diapers, large, absorbent, adult-sized diapers that can take care of that eventuality. And, you know, the space shuttle itself, you know, provides a means to get out of the suit right after you arrive in orbit, and you don't have to put the suit back on until reentry. So then you can use the bathroom facilities that we just discussed. So we're a long way from the right stuff now, and people seem to be able to deal with this quite easily.
Okay, now, what is it like spiritually and emotionally to be in orbit, to look down on the planet Earth as you are in a spacewalk, suspended, orbiting the Earth, suspended in mid-flight with this little cable that connects you to the mothercraft? What is it like to look back at the Earth?
Well, Michio, this was a great experience. I had been dreaming about spaceflight since I was 10, and here I was 39 years old on my first mission, and as I write in Skywalking, I got to orbit. I was so busy with my initial jobs that it was about an hour before I actually had a moment to look out the window. And I'll never forget that first impression of the Earth. I was looking out on the night side of Earth, and instead of stars, I saw this big round space or gap where stars should have been. That was the dark side of our planet. But on the very edge, the limb of the Earth, was a gentle band of robin's egg blue light that was growing in intensity and widening along the horizon of the Earth, and that was the coming sunrise. And this beautiful, delicate blue, and the fact that I was finally looking back at my planet after waiting for almost three decades to get there brought tears to my eyes with the realization that I had finally arrived at that moment in time and space. And, you know, they were tears of gratitude to God for sending me up there and giving me the chance to do this, and they were just tears of appreciation at the beauty that I was seeing. And throughout my experiences in space on those rest of the other three missions I flew, the view of the Earth never became boring, or I never became blasé about it. It was always riveting. I had to tear myself away from the windows to go to work because it's always such a lovely sight and so attractive to a human being to gaze on our own world.
And do you also get a sense of the fragility of life? First of all, the atmosphere is extremely thin, and yet it's like the skin of an apple, and yet it creates life on the planet Earth, not to mention the fact that the Earth is suspended in this rather hostile environment of cosmic rays and potential meteor impacts. So do you get a feeling of the fragility of humanity, that we are, quote-unquote, on spaceship Earth?
You certainly get a sense that the Earth is a varied and delicate place. You see immense variety in color and in texture as you travel around the planet once every 90 minutes. Looking at the Earth's horizon, you can see this thin blanket of the atmosphere. You can look down at night and watch meteors burning up in it below you. And you can see the air glow layer high in the atmosphere against the dark night full of stars. So it's aesthetically beautiful, and you're aware of how thin that envelope of air is in particular. I found that you wanted to get to these thousands of places on Earth that you could see, that the rainforest, the glaciers, the high mountain peaks, the river valleys. You wanted to go personally to all of these places to learn more about the planet, and yet you realize as a human being you're never going to live long enough to go to all of these places that you've seen from orbit. I felt a great attraction and sense of longing in my heart to be part of Earth, and I felt separated from it to some extent, especially thinking that I was half a world away from my family most of the time. But generally, I had this great attraction for this lovely planet of ours, and I can't imagine what the Apollo astronauts must have experienced traveling 1,000 miles farther away in space than I did. And it was so strong for me, I'm sure that they must have had a great longing to get back.
Okay, now let's talk about the downside of being in outer space. For example, the Russians set the world's record for being in outer space on one mission, being lofted into space for over a year. And when that cosmonaut came back down to Earth, he could barely crawl. He was almost like a worm. The atrophy of the muscles was so great that he could not stand up. And so let's talk about the fact that when you're in space, you have enormous muscle and bone loss.
Short-term space flight doesn't present many problems. We exercised every couple of days while we were in space. The longest trip I had was 18 days. And so if you do a medium amount of exercise for an hour every other day, you're going to keep your heart, lungs, and muscles in good enough shape to do any physical task that's required and also to withstand reentry. And then you can sort of stagger off the space shuttle and get your land legs under you just as you were coming back from a long sea voyage. And within about a half an hour, you can walk under your own steam with no great worries. You feel heavy at first when you come back to Earth. That passes in about an hour. The longest effect that I felt was about 3 days of lacking a fine sense of motor balance. So I couldn't bend over from the waist and pick up a penny on the floor. That would have just toppled me over. I had to wait until my brain became used to using those inner ear balance organs again, and it took about 3 days for those to come back online. Now, for space station astronauts, like my friend Bill MacArthur, who's headed back to Earth on April 8th here, he's been up there for more than 6 months, and he's been exercising every day for 90 minutes. He's been using both a treadmill and an exercise bike and a resistive exercise device that allows him to do the equivalent of lifting weights up there. And by combining those forms of exercise, his muscle and cardiac health will be in pretty good shape when he comes home. So I think he'll be able to walk within about an hour. He's got the benefit of a lot of experience since that Russian mission 16 or 17 years ago. He'll be able to be more mobile when he comes back. He will have, however, some loss of calcium from his skeleton. He's lost some bone mass. Some of that will recover back on Earth. He'll probably have a permanent deficit of a few percent. And, of course, we don't know the long-term repercussions of that. So while he's going to get some professional physical rehabilitation, I think he'll have no short-term ill effects, and it'll only be in the later decades of his life that he finds out whether he's got skeletal weakening that's of any consequence. It doesn't appear to be a long-term effect for these six-month space station missions. But as you understand, Mars missions are an open question.
And we should also point out that a mission to Mars has a host of other problems. First of all, Mars itself is a frozen desert. For the most part, temperatures barely rise above the melting point of ice, and so most of the time, Mars is frozen over. Second of all, atmospheric pressure is only 1% atmospheric pressure on the planet Earth, and the atmosphere is basically carbon dioxide. So you would choke if you were to try to breathe the Martian air, not to mention the fact that your blood would boil
And basically, you might even explode as a consequence of the low pressure on the planet Mars. And then to top it off, you have to worry about radiation from outer space. That's why one NASA official has stated that perhaps we should have our astronauts live in caves. Lava tubes, ancient lava tubes left over from volcanic activity on the planet Mars, would be an ideal place for our astronauts to live in order to avoid being irradiated by radiation from outer space, and also micrometeorites. And then to top it off, we have also the problem of rocket failure and mishaps. Realize that about 1% of the time, our rockets do not perform as expected and, in fact, blow up. If you take a look at the fatality rate of the space program, it's about a little over 1%. So 1% of the time, you don't come back. In fact, Mars has something called the Mars Jinx. The Mars Jinx basically means that about 3/4 of the time, unmanned missions to Mars simply don't make it because of rocket failure, explosions, because of miscalculations, because the Mars probe crashes on the surface of Mars, any number of reasons why we have the Mars Jinx. So again, it's possible, yes, we could send people to Mars, but I think that we have to be very careful when it comes to shooting human life out to the red planet. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, inviting you to join us every week when we discuss science and its impact on society. And our special guest today was Tom Jones, and we were talking about outer space. What about the costs, the hazards? Why bother to go into outer space when we have all these problems afflicting the planet Earth? What about the promise and the perils of outer space? Our special guest today was astronaut Tom Jones, who has been to the International Space Station, and he's seen the universe from above the atmosphere. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.